Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research with unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
News Talk 1360, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine present Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our listeners. Dr. Goldstein and Dr. Page are both actively involved in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. Now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And on our show today, Christy, we're going to be talking with Rabbi Daniel Graber about faith and healing, something that you and I do a lot. We don't talk about a lot, though.
No, we don't talk about it a lot, but it is something that is important to us both personally and also to our patients. So I think this will be an interesting conversation.
But first, we're going to talk about some research that matters about exercise in your 70s and 80s?
About fewer kids dying from leukemia. Good news.
Absolutely. About blueberries. I like those.
And about cancer costs and how they affect certain people more than others.
So this is a broad research that matters. And let's just talk about our very first one about what it means to be active in your 70s and your 80s.
Yeah, this was another study looking at benefits of being active compared with people who are sedentary in their older age. They looked at almost 900 people around 80 years old.
Yeah, and the Archives of Internal Medicine. And, you know, a lot of this research is, you know, perhaps on people in their 60s. And so this I was really interested in because it was, you know, these older seniors, and they followed them for 4 years and measured kind of how much they were walking and moving. And found significantly lower chances of dying, like 25% for those who were the most active compared to those who were the least active.
Well, it was interesting. They actually put in a little device to measure how physically active people were at the baseline. It makes me wonder, perhaps if I knew there was a device measuring this, if I was healthy enough to exercise, I'd probably do a little more while they were testing me.
I thought that too, but they said they controlled for kind of the baseline levels of obesity and physical activity. Mm-hmm. So theoretically, this wasn't a randomized controlled trial, but it did really look like that this is certainly beneficial and not harmful.
No, and it benefits so many aspects of our lives. So, and it's plausible that, you know, people who are more active are going to live a little bit longer.
You know what the next research is going to be, Christy?
What?
People in their 90s. They're going to extend this research out for another 10 years. And you're finding people in their 90s benefit from exercise. I know it's on the horizon. Let's talk about our next research that matters.
Okay. Well, this is on the other spectrum, looking at children who have the certain type of leukemia called ALL, which is the most common type of childhood cancer.
Right. And they've actually had really good collection of the patients in long-term research studies. And this was a study of over 20,000 teens and children and babies that were affected with this type of cancer, and looking at survival over the last 20 years and showing increased survival really to a level that, wow, most of these patients are surviving at least 5 years.
Yeah. They looked at over 21,000 kids and adolescents up to age 22. And in the first segment, 83 or 84% who were diagnosed between 1990 and 1994 were still alive 5 years later, looking at about 80% surviving 10 years. But the ones who were diagnosed between 2000 and 2005, not that much longer, a higher percentage. So almost 91% survived 5 years, and 10 years was also going up. So people are living longer, hopefully because of better medicines and earlier diagnosis.
And the benefits, this was a really nice area. The benefits were the true, depending if they were white, black, or Hispanic, those with high-risk forms of the cancer and the low-risk forms of cancer. The only ones who didn't seem to have a much greater benefit were the very small infants diagnosed at a young age, and we could understand perhaps why, given the overwhelming nature. But this is really good news, and one worth sharing. And we expect to see these advances continue because there will be we know how to combine the drugs and really prevent some of these infections and treat them.
Mm-hmm. So the next study is about blueberries and apples, which makes me happy because those are the two fruits that are around in my house because that's almost all that my son will eat.
So what about pears?
They eat pears, they do. But blueberries and apples are very popular in my household. And apparently, according to the study, eating more blueberries, apples, and pears may be linked to lower risk of diabetes.
Yes, this was in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, and they looked at over 200,000 men and women for up to 24 years. They get my respect and admiration for following that many
people for that long of time. It's somebody's whole life's work.
Oh, yes. And then finding out that none of these patients had diabetes at the outset, but over 12,000 of them developed it during the follow-up period. And what was the impact of taking these blueberries and apples and pears on their chances of getting diabetes?
And they found, so they're looking at these fruits and vegetables that are loaded with the flavonoids. And we talked about that recently in a different study. But these particular fruits showed that they are beneficial for preventing type 2 diabetes, and that the blueberry lovers had 23% lower risk of developing type 2 diabetes compared with people who ate no blueberries.
Right, and this would suggest that there is a better benefit here for eating the whole fruit rather than just the fruit juice, where you may not get that same level of flavonoids. But you know what, Christy, it reminds me a new mantra here. Blueberries, apples, and pears. Oh, my. Blueberries, apples, and pears. Oh, my.
I love it.
We love it.
Oh, my.
Let's do our very last research that matters.
Well, this is an oh, my, actually.
This is an oh, my, right? It's the type of news that none of us want to hear, but yet it really is something we have to talk about.
Okay. This was a survey showing that colon cancer patients younger than 50 years of age and those who started out with low income levels or who were unemployed were most likely to experience very severe financial hardship because of the treatments that were meant to save their lives.
And, you know, we know that the diagnosis of cancer can be really costly, and, you know, but it's not just about the cost of the treatment. That can be tens of thousands of dollars over a short period of time. It's that people then are taken away from work environments, so their income level goes down. And those at the most need, the least financially advantageous, are the ones that suffer the most.
Yeah, they surveyed 555 adults who were living in Washington State who had advanced colon cancer. And of the 284 people who responded, almost 40% of them had at least one serious financial hardship related to their cancer treatment.
And another 27% had other financial impacts. They had to sell stocks or take money out of their savings or retirement accounts. This is just devastating.
And yet another small percent, 5 to 7%, didn't do their treatments or refuse their treatments because of the cost. And in most of these situations, the patients did not bring it up to their doctor. So it wasn't necessarily part of the conversation, but yet the young people under age 50 and the ones who had initial financial hardship really were the ones that were struck the hardest.
Right. This also in the Journal of Clinical Oncology suggests that when a cancer is diagnosed among any of our listeners' families, please let your doctor know. Because your doctor might be able to help. They might be able to get a social worker, like in our PCMH, we have social workers that might be able to help to get the drugs at more discount.
There could be drug company discounts or other possibilities through clinical trials.
When my father-in-law, Christy, was diagnosed with cancer last year, the cost of the drug, the chemotherapy, was a couple thousand dollars a month. And, you know, if we started the drug in the hospital, we actually would have had to pay more than starting as an outpatient. And then it turned out that because he was a veteran, we could get some differential benefits and then activating insurance. But, you know, these things aren't obvious. And here I am as a doctor. My wife's a doctor. So please contact us, your doctors, and get a social worker involved.
Absolutely. So we've had a chance to talk about cancer costs, some good news about blueberries, apples, and pears. Oh my.
About good news about leukemia, ALL, and improved survival.
And good news about staying active as seniors, perhaps extending life.
And that'll conclude Research That Matters. We'll take a short break. When we return, we'll be talking with Rabbi Daniel Graber about faith and healing. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 843-5112 or email yourhealth health@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Adam, we're going to be talking with Rabbi at Bethel Synagogue, Rabbi Daniel Graber, about health and healing. And we're looking forward to that conversation between the three of us.
Yeah, I want to welcome Rabbi Graber to Your Health. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
You know, I am a member at Bethel Synagogue, and it was just several weeks ago, I think, Rabbi, that you and I were talking, and I'm not quite sure the full context, but we were talking about faith and healing, and discovered this is something obviously, you know, obvious to maybe externally thinking, oh, yes, a rabbi and a minister, well, you know, they'd be interested in this, but you were really uniquely interested. How did you come to have some interest in thinking about faith and healing?
When I got here, I recently arrived to the area, and first of all, there's so many medical companies, and health is such a big part of the culture here. So part of it is just trying to understand the people in our congregation. But I also, some of my formative experiences were as an athlete and taking care of my body. And when I became religious and decided to study to be a rabbi, I was always very impacted by the relationship between the health of my body and the health of my spirit, of my soul, the way that I walk through the world.
It's interesting. As a person of Christian faith, and I believe this to be true in the Jewish faith as well, when you're deeply connected with your spiritual life, it's hard for me to fathom thinking of my medical health outside of my spiritual health and well-being. And I wonder to the extent that that's true for most people of various faiths. And is it really possible to separate them out? What do you think? Do most people think of them separately or intertwined?
I think sometimes there are ascetic tendencies where people will not think about their bodies and view their bodies as something that they just need to get away from and sort of go internally and away from a life that's, you know, considering the body. But I think in a healthy approach, in a balanced approach, if you're a person who is taking care of your body, then you're also a person who's taking care of your soul, and the other way around too. I think that if you're in its best manifestations, if you're a person who is committed to a religious tradition, then you're living a life of balance.
You know, I know I want to come back at some point in time to this question because I've heard you talk about it. You know, people are surprised when they see you exercising, as if a spiritual leader shouldn't exercise, and that can have its own both private and public elements. And I do want to come back to that, but I want to just actually ask a very basic question. When we talk about healing, we kind of know what we're talking about. Certainly, Christy and I, you know, you can very publicly see people get better and see people get sicker. What are we talking about when we say faith? How do you define that? And is that fairly universal? So you know faith when you see it.
I think in the Jewish tradition, there's a word for faith called emunah. And emunah means that you do something over and over again. So we understand God as faithful in giving us a chance over and over again. And when we're faithful, we are faithful in a marriage, or we are faithful in our jobs, and we're faithful in different parts of our lives because we're consistent. And I think in some religious traditions, faith is sort of a leap. It's understood as, well, this is, you know, beyond reason, or it's beyond something that I can explain. And in the way that I've always approached faith as something that you stick with and you do over and over again. And that to me is the connection between faith and health, because I think that health isn't sort of once and for all being healthy, but rather I've always understood it as somebody who can get sick but then can return back to being healthy.
Well, let's stick with that for a second, because when we talk about faith and you think about faithful and faithfulness, and the first thing that I think about, well, is in marriage. And we know that a third, a half of all marriages have unfaithfulness in there. Spiritually, if faithful is about repetitive doing of something and believing in something, aren't you setting yourself up sometimes then for failure because you can't do it repetitively perfectly? So what is this idea of repeating something, but yet also knowing that you maybe can't repeat it to the level of faith?
Well, that's why I think it's such a wonderful model, because if you miss a swim workout, okay, you've missed a swim workout, but then you go back to the next swim workout and, you know, going to that next swim workout isn't a waste of your time. It's one more opportunity to improve your health and to improve the sort of shape that you're in. And what ends up happening is your body ends up being a barometer for the extent to which you have been faithful in your particular regimen. So I think sometimes people approach religion, they approach God and say, well, if I'm not going to do this, then I might as well not do anything at all. And I say, no, you know, everything that we do is a step forward. Everything that we do is another opportunity, but it's not all or nothing.
Well, and it's a different perspective in the Christian faith, where that's already been done, and so you can't earn it. And so it's just a little bit of a different framework in how we think about faith and sort of striving to do better ever life through that deep relationship, which is, it's interesting to hear the similarities and the differences there. But thinking about healing too, so much of thinking about chronic illness or thinking about the death of a loved one or thinking about your own mortality is so tied in with your spiritual concept of, is there something bigger than this world or not? And how much do you trust science or not? How many answers does your doctor have versus not? And so healing itself, I think we think is just, do you get better or do you not? But yet there's so much of that internal healing, emotional and spiritual healing, that is required of people that overlap so much with faith and context, that even just those words, faith and healing, we could spend the whole show just talking about what exactly is that.
Well, and I think that when doctors are confronted with somebody who's physically physically is not healthy and needs to return, there's a part of that that comes through medicines, but there's a whole other part of care that talks about, how is it that we can bring this person, how is it that we can take care of this person? And that may happen in some medical settings, but there's a big role that religious communities, whether they be a synagogue or a mosque or a church, religious communities offer a safety net. They offer a way of taking care of not just the person, but also the caregivers, of taking care of the whole family and giving an opportunity to think about, wow, how do I understand what I've just been through?
And thinking about that, sometimes I think doctors are trained to think about church communities or faith communities, whatever that religion might be, as a resource to help their patients. If a patient's plugged in, there may be counseling resources, there may be support from members of that faith community. But there are also a lot of linkages with pastoral care and the hospital setting. And I wonder what sort of training on the pastoral end and on the doctor end we either offer or should be offering about how to work together.
I think a challenge for all pastors, for all leaders of faith communities, is not only how do I, as a rabbi, be present in a setting where somebody is very sick or somebody is on their deathbed, but also how do I prepare a community to be ready to be present for so many people who are struggling with illness? Because and really, it's not rocket science. It's not too hard, but it does take courage. Sometimes it takes a lot of courage just to be present, just to hold somebody's hand, just to sit with someone who may feel very much like, medical settings, especially in hospitals, can be very technical, can be very mechanical, and they can be very dehumanizing. And that human touch and that presence with someone else is of a tremendous value. And the more people in faith communities who can have the courage and be given some of that training to be present for people, I think that creates a stronger community.
Well, we're going to need to take a short break, but when we come back, I think I'd like to pick up on this topic of two things that you've raised. One is the individual and the individual characteristics of the faith, but also this communal response, because that's not one that I think we talk about very often, and they perhaps have different implications. We're going to take a short break, but when we can turn, we'll continue our conversation with Rabbi Daniel Graber about faith and healing. You're listening to Your Health. We'll be right back.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on WCHL. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Rabbi Daniel Graber about faith and healing. And Rabbi Graber, as you were talking before, I was thinking about both the individual and the communal level, but individually it reminded me of a conversation I had with four or five of my guy friends a couple years ago when the question was, well, do you believe in God? And it turned out I was the only one of the five or six friends who said, yes,
really?
I believe in God. But yet these were all very, in some respects, religious Jews. And so the question is belief in God a requirement of having faith, and how does that relate to healing?
So I have when I think about what it means to have faith, I'll sort of reiterate what I said before. To me, it's less, faith isn't a possession that you have inside you or that you can hold in your hand. It's something that it gets lived out. And when somebody loses faith, I think it's they lose their willingness to continue to come back and to be in relationship and strive to have some sort of relationship with God. And I think, you know, as it relates to healing, it's just, you know, it's very interesting that there's been a number of studies actually by someone here in the area, Dr. Harold Koenig from Duke University, where they've sort of, he's looked into, and these are peer-reviewed studies, and looked into the correlation between religiosity and health.
And they found what? What did he find?
Well, he found that there is a strong correlation, but you can't measure sort of what somebody has within inside. What you can measure is, number one, whether somebody prays outside of their synagogue or church or mosque. Number two, if somebody studies the Bible. And number three, does somebody participate in community services, in prayer services? And when those three things are present, it's very interesting, and it correlates with a prolonged life. And it also correlates with a number of better outcomes for treatments when people are afflicted with various ailments. And I don't believe that that means that, I don't believe that God is like a vending machine where if you put in the prayer coins and you pull the lever, then the candy of longer life comes out. I don't think that that's how it works. And I think that that belief can be very destructive for people because some people pray. We all know people who pray and who are afflicted with illness and they don't live longer lives. But I do think that it's an insight into what the structure of religious life and what the structure of faith communities can offer to people, not only as an emotional benefit, but also as a health benefit.
I know there are also studies showing more broadly about prayer in general being helpful in certain afflictions. And I'm always struck, too, by research saying that many patients want their doctors to bring up faith, that they want, that patients actually want us to bring it up. And yet I think doctors are a lot of times hesitant to bring it up, and either by way of offending someone or for some doctors who aren't people who have a particular faith, maybe being uncomfortable talking about it. And I wonder from your experience what your take is on that. If patients want doctors to bring it up, is it important for the doctor to know that they have the same faith? Or, you know, what should we be teaching doctors about raising this issue and supporting the patients?
Well, I think that doctors should keep an openness to that as part of patients' needs. And I think that there's an extent to which doctors can provide real treatments that people need to that are helpful for people, but there is a certain extent to which people are also their own healers. We all know stories of people who are given prescriptions to take, and if they don't take those pills, then they're not going to be able to get better. I think that people need to make a decision about the sort of treatments and the sort of path to healing that they want. And if a patient is saying, you know, this is part of how I need to understand the journey that I'm about to embark upon with illness and with healing, I don't think a doctor needs to bring that up. And I have to be honest with you, there's a piece of me that would be uncomfortable because I'm a Jew and I don't have an expectation that my doctor be Jewish. And I might be, it might be uncomfortable for me if somebody brought up, a Christian faith or another faith in that medical setting. But if the doctor was responding to something that I was bringing up and was open to it and encouraging of my continuing to make that a part of my healing, I think that that can be helpful. And I think that's a good perspective.
Well, we entitled the show Faith in Healing, not Faith in Illness. And so that does imply that there is something intrinsically healing potentially about faith. And you mentioned previously about a communal response. I wonder if you can, maybe you can think of some examples or share some examples from your experience of how does a community, because I think in today's society, we frequently have a more difficult time sometimes defining communities, particularly as we get so busy and we're in a larger cities and growth. How does a community respond or provide this type of ideal?
I think that people ask me sometimes, you know, Rabbi, what do you think about spirituality versus religion? And I think that this is one of those areas where religion is very different from spirituality, where faith, as it's understood within organized religion, is different from spirituality because so many faith communities organize themselves and understand faith not only as an individual decision or an individual path, but as a communal path. And so when one person is ill, that person's illness has an effect on the whole faith community, and the structure of the faith community, the structure of the faith itself, provides an impetus for involvement and provides an impetus for taking care of not only the physical part of the person, but their whole self. And I think that that's part of what we're talking about here today is the fact that we are not just our bodies and we're not just our souls, but we are whole selves. And that vision of healing both individually and communally involves both of those things.
Well, I know, and just to disclose, Rabbi Graber knows that, and Christy knows that I just recently lost my father-in-law, and the community responding in ways of, in my faith and Jewish tradition, of having a meal and bringing together to pray and to say the rituals. And I was telling someone how that just felt so nurturing to have a community that kind of takes care of me. And I suspect that you, as a leader, that this is part of what you want to see the community and help the community do.
I think that it is what all communities should do. We are here to communicate a simple truth to one another, which is that you're not alone in your loss. You're not alone if you're struggling with illness. You're not alone if you're suffering. You're not alone if you've suffered a loss in your family. And another way you could think about faith is showing up. just showing up and being present for someone, whether it's in a hospital room or whether it's in a home, where, yes, you're going to pray, but I think that those prayers, they are for God, but they're also for all of us, because they're an opportunity to come together and to focus on what's most important in our lives.
Well, Rabbi Graber, thank you for taking time to be with us today. Thank you for the support that you're providing to your community, and particularly to you, Adam. And we are sorry for your loss.
Well, I appreciate that. This issue is a large one, and I think as we have this fragmented healthcare system, to focus on people and what we do for each other, it's what Christy and I, as family doctors, take near and dear to heart, and our colleagues in the faith community, perhaps we do need to continue to reach out, because the skills that you bring, Rabbi Graber, are unique and important. So we want to thank you for being with us today.
Thank you. And I want to say I'm very humbled always by the doctors who I meet and by the ongoing work. It's not easy work, and I'm very humbled to be able to be a partner in the work of healing with you.
We're going to have to take a short break, but coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. For our House Call segment of our show today, Christy, we're going to talk about listeners' health questions and concerns.
And if you have a question you want us to address, send your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. Adam, we've got some House Calls today about kidney stones, about weight loss,
about lung cancer and hospice,
and about neuropathy, and we'll talk about what that means.
Let's listen to our very first House Call from a listener whose family has kidney stones.
My mother was just in the emergency room with kidney stones, which she passed on her own. What is my risk of getting kidney stones? Is there anything I can do with my diet to avoid them?
Well, first off, we're glad that the kidney stones passed on their own. I have not had a kidney stone, and I can't say I know what it's like, but from our listeners and our patients who've had them, we know they're pretty bad. Been told they're kind of as close as you could get to childbirth, though Christy, I know nothing compares to childbirth.
Don't say that. Although I have not had a kidney stone, so I could not compare the two. But my sister did, and so this raises a similar question for me.
And was it comparable to her?
Oh, I don't know. I would never attempt to estimate pain.
We do know
that
the kidney stones are incredibly painful, and so how to cut down on your risk of getting kidney stones and how to prevent them are great questions.
Well, and it raises a question of, is one kidney stone in your mom, does that really raise your risk very much? And what are the things that raise your risk? So the people who are considered to be higher risk for stone recurrence are
those who are heavier or obese.
Mm-hmm. Middle-aged white males who have a family history of stones are more likely. African Americans or people.
Yeah, no, I mean, I'd say we know here in the South, people who are in kind of that type of climate tend to have higher risk, and probably because of some dehydration in the summer months.
And people who have chronic diarrhea or have problems with absorption, have had bowel surgery. There are a variety of medical conditions that would predispose.
I didn't know that.
Interesting. Yes,
we're always learning. And one of the questions is, what can you do about it? And certainly the single best thing you can do, because some of these things are not in your control, but what maybe is in your control, in addition to having an optimal weight, is staying hydrated. And there is actually some good research that you can cut down on your risk of kidney stones, you know, if you don't get dehydrated. Now, you don't mean you have to go out and drink 2 liters of fluid every day, but for people who don't drink any liquids much in their meals, by drinking, one or two quarts of water a day, you can cut down on your risk.
And there are different types of kidney stones and different types of diets you could follow to reduce your risk of getting one of those types of stones. But I got to tell you, if I were you and it was just one stone in one relative, I don't know, other than keeping a healthy weight, trying to avoid diabetes, and drinking lots of water, I don't know that I would.
You wouldn't follow
on a
low oxalate diet, Christy, or a low purine diet. Basically, if you cut out protein and you cut out fruits, vegetables, and nuts, not so easy.
We'll ask our health services sciences librarians to put something, a link on about kidney stones and about special diets.
Yeah, there's from the National Kidney Stone Foundation. There's some really good research. Well, let's listen to our very next house call, actually about losing weight.
I've tried a lot of different things to lose weight, but none of them have worked very well. In the end, I put back on any weight that I managed to lose. What can you recommend as good resources or a good program that I could consider to really try to reach a healthier weight?
Oh, I hear this a lot. This is a really difficult issue. I empathize, and I know, because if losing weight were easy, people would do it more often. It's not easy.
It's not easy. And there are lots of diets that have some modest benefits. We've talked about many of them on the show, Adam. Some people really favor a low-carb diet. Other people really favor doing a program like Weight Watchers. And the big thing that I counsel patients about is to try to adopt, to think of it not as a diet, but as real lifestyle change, to really change what you're doing on a day-to-day basis and think about food differently.
I couldn't agree with you more, Christy. And part of it is, when you really get down there and you talk with your provider, it's going to be cutting down on the amount of calories you take in versus what you expend, and doing that on a consistent basis, whether that's in a dietary program or a self-home diet, or ultimately if you had surgery, which surgically requires you to probably take in less calories.
I would encourage you to talk with your doctor about a team approach. You can talk with a nutritionist. There's certain types of health counselors, behavioral counselors who can help. There are really well-done programs like Weight Watchers and others that can help you with that team approach of thinking about diet and exercise and how all of that stuff interrelates.
Sounds very good, Christy. Let's listen to our very next house call, a very difficult case.
My mother recently was in hospice and died of lung cancer. We were told she was dying and expected her death any day. She actually lived for another week with heavy medications. Can doctors estimate better when a patient with final stages of cancer is going to die?
Well, that's a really difficult situation. And first off, thank you for sharing that situation. It's not one that we frequently talk about, but the question you raise is one that everyone has to deal with just about.
And I'm sorry to hear about your loss and your mother. And I think this is one of those situations where science doesn't always have exact answers. And you certainly know this from this experience, but it can take people's bodies do different things at that end stage of life.
You know, we can sometimes, like the weather, we can say what the weather is probably going to be like 3 months from now. We can say what the weather is going to be like 3 hours from now, but it's really difficult to say. And the human body is sometimes not so predictable to say, you know, if your blood pressure was really, really low, you know, 40 systolic, and your pulse rate was 30, we might think that you would pass away within the next few hours to a day. But you know what? The body is pretty resilient and remarkable. And we've seen, Christy and I have seen patients that live without food and water for 7, 10, 12 days even. So it's not a perfect science.
It's not. But I am hopeful that you had support, that you have support now in the process of your grieving, and appreciate that you reached out to share your experience and ask the question.
And also, I'm really happy that your mother was in hospice with the lung cancer, because hospice has actually been shown to improve survival with patients with lung cancer. So you did the right things. Your family did the right things. Thank you for sharing with us. Let's listen to our very last house call.
I have neuropathy and have successfully treated it with Neurontin for several years. Recently, I decided to start cutting back on the medication because the large doses make me sleepy. To my pleasant surprise, thus far, my neuropathy hasn't returned, and I'm on half my previous dose. Do you think I can get off the Neurontin completely?
Well, I think this is good news. If you're able to cut down on the medicine, good news that the Neurontin helped your pain or the neuropathy, and also good that as you're cutting back on it, you haven't had a return of your symptoms. I think that is good news, and you are appropriately questioning and proceeding with caution, because no one wants that to come back.
And a lot of patients are on very large doses of Neurontin to treat their neuropathy, up to 3,600 milligrams. Mm-hmm. That's a lot of Neurontin. And yeah, I can see how that made you sleepy and tired. So slowly cutting back, I don't know what you would say, Christy, 300 milligrams every few days.
And then if you start having any symptoms of the neuropathy and you're willing to continue taking the Neurontin, then I would go back up by 300 milligrams to get to that place where you're not having the pain if you can tolerate it with the sleepiness.
Well, we hope that you will continue on your path to healing. And we want to thank every one of our listeners who sent us a house call today. We've hoped we've addressed issues that are important to you and your health.
And we want you to email us at yourhealth@unc.edu, visit us online at yourhealthradio.org, go to Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, get podcasts, get our app on your smartphone.
Get our app by searching Your Health in one word and Radio in the second word.
And we'd like to thank the staff of WCHL, the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Rabbi Daniel Graber. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And we'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Bye-bye.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page has been brought to you by UNC Family Medicine for the Chapel Hill Carborough community. You can hear Your Health on Saturdays at 9 a.m., Sundays at 9 and 5, and Mondays at 6 and 10 p.m. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine and News Talk 1360, WCHL.